Welcome to Gin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese medicineism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Hey, fellow G&Ters, those of us like our spirituality with a twist. As you will have already heard in the introduction, we have the distinct pleasure and privilege of having on Dr. Neil Theis, the author of Notes on Complexity. And thank you so much for coming on. We're going to call you Neil. We agreed in the pre. In the pre, we'll drop the formalities. But thanks so much for coming on, Neil.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So given we have so much we want to talk about, we'll dive right in. We like to do this thing, which is sort of like the NPR show, This American Life. We kind of like to do This American Spiritual Life. So we thought we would go a little bit into sort of your backstory. Our idea for doing this is always that it's good to learn about the people and see where their ideas come from, but also I think it's something kind of inspiring. We always think that about hearing how people got to where they are, especially people who are maybe a little bit on the road, less traveled, a little bit thinking about things in new ways. And obviously you're certainly doing that. Your book is such a wonderful example of that. So we're going to do it about that to start off with. And the first thing that occurred was really, in the book, you talk about the impression I got was of you as kind of a very curious kid who was interested in nature and science, but then ultimately you become this serious Zen practitioner too. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of hear about more of the science part of your early experiences, but I was just curious, like, did you come from a background where there was religious and spiritual things? I know you come from Jewish ancestry. Was there Kabbalistic things? Like, was there any precursors for that part?
I have to reread the book. I no longer know what's in it. This either made it into the final version or not. It was always sort of a balanced thing with me. I feel like, looking back, my scientific interests and my spiritual interests sort of derived from the same place, which is some sort of innate sense of intimacy with the world around us. And it expressed themselves, there wasn't a need when I was really small to, like, how am I going to approach this? There were lots of options. And when I started being able to read and doing school, I discovered the science side of things and so went that way. But my parents were from Europe. My dad was born in Germany, which really wasn't good in the 1920s, 30s. He escaped. His parents sent him to England on something called the Kinder Transport. And when he was almost 13, 5 days before Germany invaded Poland, he was sent to England and never saw his parents again. Wound up in England. My mother's family came from Poland, also Jewish. On the eve of World War I, my grandparents had a sense that, get out of here. And their journey took them to England. And my grandfather on her side became very wealthy. It took quite a while to get there, but she was sort of raised as an English princess. And my dad was this German orphan. My dad met her when she was 12 and he was 14 and fell in love, but couldn't speak to her because the orphan doesn't speak to the princess. They independently came to the US, met again by chance. And, and here I am. So I grew up in West Hartford, Connecticut, where they settled because some of my father's surviving relatives were there. The synagogue I grew up in was primarily German Holocaust survivors. And so there's, you know, maybe we'll get to some of the things that pass for humor in my family. It's a little strange. But growing up in that community and with my parents, what I used to say when people ask, you know, like, are you Reform, conservative, Orthodox? Well, we weren't sort of in any of those American contingents, but we were more, we were sort of conservative, but we were more observant than the average American Jewish family. Mm-hmm. And my mom's experience of her spiritual life was very rich, very deep. I eventually came to understand as she entered her later years, this is the book I want to write in part, that she had a real deep, intimate experience of divinity. And that was something in her family. And it's a long line of rabbis on that side of the family. And then I discovered later in life, all those scholars who were rabbinic scholars, meaning largely legal scholars, they were all mystics too. So that's sort of, you know, one line of descent. But we were the generation of the survivors. And so Jewish practice as it was given to us was, you know, we weren't tortured or abused or oppressed by our parents with Jewish practice. We were treasures in this community. And so, I think not everyone wound up as interested or observant as I was. And I used to be much more observant on the Jewish side of things when I was younger. But still, it was a very rich way to grow up. And so I wasn't afraid of spiritual practice. And then, but it sort of came to a head in one way when I was 14 or 15, I think 14. Is this story in the book about the beach and the Holocaust?
I don't think so.
No, okay. I don't think so.
I don't think so, no.
So, you know, if you grow up as a child of a Holocaust survivor, you're and religious, like, what the hell do you do with that? Yeah. Hello, God, where were you?
The Odyssey problem, kind of, right?
Yeah. And so there was this, you know, in Zen terms, great doubt. This doesn't make sense. It just doesn't fit together. And a friend, a love interest of one of my father's cousins who was visiting from Canada, she was trying to, I think, get in good with our family, make a good impression. And she saw I was a reader. And she gave me a book called The Source by James Michener, who people my age, everyone, you know, he was a best-selling author. He wrote a dozen bestsellers and they were all like that thick. Like 800 pages. And he would pick a location and then write an epic saga that might go back as far as prehistory and trace things up to the present day. And one of those was called The Source. And it was the Middle East, and more specifically, an archaeological site that he made up, but it had elements of reality in Israel. And in chapter something in the middle, it was the 15th century in a town called Sfat, which is where Yitzhak Luria, who's one of the most important Kabbalists in history, had his community there. And that was my introduction to the idea of mystical anything. Mm-hmm. I'd never really, in my mom's world, there was, there's magical stuff. Another thing in our family, the Yiddish writer, Isaac Besheva Singer, who's won the Nobel Prize, his stories are filled with demons and magic and stuff like that. And that's also very much my lineage. He was a cousin. But this gave me the idea of, oh, you can have an experience of being so intimate with the divine that maybe you get to see things from that perspective. And maybe from that perspective, I called it the God's eye view. And the beach part, I was telling this to a friend of mine when we were walking down the beach when I was 14. I said, you know, I think if you can experience things from the God's eye view, all of this makes sense.
Mm.
And so that sort of became the beginning of my wanting to find some sort of mystical practice. There wasn't a lot available if you were a middle-class gay Jewish kid who wasn't Orthodox in West Hartford, Connecticut, back in the 1970s. Now there's plenty. We have the internet,
Right.
But, you can do Zohar online. But back then, no. And
the amazing part, Neil, in the Bahir, where they make that kind of point, it says something like, from the point of view of relative beings, everything looks the way it is. But from the point of view of like Ein Sof, everything has always just been Ein Sof all the time.
Right, right.
You know, it's that, that idea, right? And I remember reading that and just going like,
right. But that's, Nirvana Samsara.
Mm-hmm.
Not two, not one.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I mean, when you get down to the fundamental levels of stuff, and that's kind of chapter 12 of the book, I can't remember, across many different traditions and cultures of metaphysical and mystical practice, that's sort of, the perennial philosophy, as some people will call it. And you can go overboard oversimplifying that because there are real differences. But at the same time, the commonalities are real too. A friend in college, because I've been talking about this but not doing anything, and a friend in college gave me a book called The Three Pillars of Zen by Roshi Philip Kaplow, which was one of the first written by an American Zen teacher, trained by Japanese teachers, about the basics of Zen practice, as well as a whole bunch in the back of the book, people's personal reports of their experiences of enlightenment experiences, Kensho, awakenings. And reading those, I was like, this reads like the stuff I've read from Jewish mystics from the 500 years ago, but it's people today, or relatively, in their own terms. So that's what led me to Zen practice. And I have a real connection with Tibetan practice, which you had mentioned was sort of where
my home base now, Daniel's part.
There's some weird karmic thing between me and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I keep winding up in his presence every few years. It's really strange. I physically bumped into him once by accident. And we both startled. How do you do that? But that's another story. But like Tibetan practice, there are all these images and tanka paintings and idols, and that's not Jewish.
Yeah.
But Zen sort of, I could pretend it was agnostic enough that I could slip myself into Zen practice and not feel conflicted.
Right.
For a while, I tried to do some syncretic stuff, like on my Zen Rakusu, the little black miniature, robes monk that Zen people wear. I actually put the tzitzis from a talus, the fringe from a Jewish prayer shawl on that. And then when I wanted to take them off because I realized I didn't need to do this, my teacher said, no, a lot of people ask you about it and it's a teaching thing for you. So no, you have to keep them on. And then someone stole that rakusu. So I wasn't going to put tzitzis on. So that it's my first three decades were sort of, that's a sum of things.
We did that a certain amount of episodes last year where Carl Jung was talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And he, when you look at his memories, dreams, reflections, he talks about feeling this tension in him between maybe like the more sciencey part and the more mystic part. He almost says like personality one and personality two, and he's really trying to figure that out. And he got into medicine, I guess, as his sort of compromise around that. I'll do psychiatry to blend these two things together. But it sounds like for you, you didn't really feel as much of that tension in you. It seems like it's sort of more naturally blended, or...
I'd like to think that, but there is this letter in the archives that one of my cousins on the German side went to Israel, married a woman from Texas, fundamentalist Christian, who found herself converting to Judaism.
Mm.
And they met, and as she went further and further to the right, he followed her in, and they came back from Israel, Lubavitcher Hasidim, and with nine children. And
wow.
And I was the one in the family she was sure she could snag. And talk about dodged bullets. Within inches, I spent lots of time in Crown Heights at 770 with in the room with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and she sent me things to read. And I remember her sending me this book about the Rebbe talking about how to, you know, how you can get science and Jewish concepts to, you know, share space. And it was, you know, the kind of things like, well, the Torah says the world is 5,000 plus years old. And so how do you explain dinosaurs? Well, you know, fossils were hidden to give us, you know, it's like, I thought that was bullshit at the time. But what I wrote to her was, I don't have to worry about this stuff because I keep the religion stuff over here in my brain. Yeah. And in a separate compartment, I keep the science stuff. And I don't really care whether they talk to each other. So looking back, I'd like to think, oh, I was this well integrated. But I recognized in myself that I had actually put walls between them and just, I'm a Gemini. So I was like, we'll do this and then we'll do that. And so, then we'll do this.
Fellow Gemini, and I can vibe with that vibe.
So you and I were in Mexico last month. For different reasons, and I didn't see you there, but maybe next year. But we were leading a plant medicine retreat at our friend's retreat center, Kumankaya, which is about an hour south of, or whatever direction is past Tulum. But the it's a husband and wife team, and the husband, and we've had them on the podcast before, super interesting guy. He was he's from France, and he was a monk, lived in a monastery for about 20 years and was the abbot for like 10 years. And now he said he traded the walls of the monastery for the trees of the jungle. Cause him and his wife run this place. And just like you, he has his religious practice, his prayers to God. And then he has his work with the medicine and the plants and his teachings and stuff that he shares with the people from his experience. But in no way are they conflicting, because he's like creation created this, and he is working with this, and that there's absolutely no tension behind those things, and it just fits well for him. So I wanted to, you know, share that with you, because I've heard this before, and it seems like those people are not even well adjusted, because there was never really much tension there to begin with.
Although, and this did not go in the book, but it's in these regards the most important thing is that because of the complexity theory stuff, they ceased to be separate things on an experiential level. And so I was comfortable never looking for, there are people who spend lots of their life looking for some way to integrate. Jung, I guess. And the Jungians are waking up to my book. It's interesting. I've been invited by the Jungian analysts of Rome in April to go talk to them. So I have to learn about how Jung relates to what I've written. Seem to think that there's a meeting point there, but I've been a Freudian my whole life, so I have to go dig up Jung. But so complexity, since we're on it,
complexity theory,
is basically how living things interact with each other to create larger scale structures of living things. It's how you explain how life evolves. It's how you explain why life always ends. It's a good way to think about how life arose within the universe. And that's a significant piece of what the book's about. This came to me, pardon me, Jewish nose, always runny, pardon me.
You're good.
So these were separate domains for me. And by this time, I'm very ensconced in my Zen practice, and my science practice is really hitting its stride with the stem cell research I did, the late 90s, early aughts. And I was put together with this artist named Jane Prophet. This is in the intro to the book. And for an art science collaboration stuff. And I was talking to her about how cells in the body move around and interact with each other to lead to regeneration, repair, or if it goes awry, cancer. And she said that the way I was talking about them was very much the way complexity theory talks about how ants self-organize into colonies, or how slime molds can either be single cells or a living being with its own organs and stuff like this, and then go back to being cells. And so this is how I got introduced to complexity theory. And we continued to collaborate. And at some point in the months after we started talking, and I was pondering the complexity stuff, I started becoming really aware that when I study stem cells, I'm either looking at things I'm doing with animals. I did animal research for a little while. I don't do it anymore. Don't like it. But I was doing it. Or because I'm a diagnostic pathologist, I have access to human tissues that from biopsies and resection specimens. So that's mostly what I do research-wise. I'm looking at human tissues. And that's where my stem cell work started. I was looking in human tissues. And it suddenly occurred to me that I think about those cells as out there in the mouse or on the slide that I'm looking at under the microscope. But this is me that I'm studying. I have these cells in me. And once I started to think about that, I had to start thinking about, you know, a colony of ants looks like a thing from a distance. But if you go up closer, you see that it's not a thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a phenomenon arising from ants interacting. And now talking to Jane, I'm realizing that a body looks like a thing of this level of scale. We have three things talking to each other, mm-hmm. And that seem separate and bounded by our skin. But when you go in close enough, which I do every day because I'm looking at microscope slides of humans, the thingness of the body disappears. And it's just a phenomenon arising from cells interacting with each other. So am I a body or am I cells?
Neil, were you already doing your Zen at that point? Were you a Zen student?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So that has a very Buddhist a vibe to it. It's a kind of a koan. It's a kind of a shunyata thing, right?
Yeah.
It has that vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. And no, it very specifically does. Now, I wasn't thinking in those terms yet, but I was kind of aware that I could not stop thinking about it. It became this really kind of obsessive thing, like a koan does. I don't think I was yet doing koan practice. I'm not sure. Yes, I was. I've been doing koan practice for about 5 years.
Just intellectual curiosity, in that, Neil. Are you more Soto or Rinzai or
I'm in
the two? Or
yeah, sort of a mix. I'm in the Miyazumi lineage from UCLA Zen Center. So and he got Dharma transmission through both. And so some of us do Shikantaza, some of us do koans, many of us flip back and forth.
My Zen teacher said it was always the koan that was most personal. You know, we could give you a koan, but the one that shows up more naturally for you, that's the one that's really going to mean something to you, right? That's
right.
From your own being.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it often comes to you unbidden. So I wasn't looking for this. And I was walking down the street. I live in New York City. And I came to a corner on Park Avenue and there was a stop sign. So I was standing at the corner and is my body a body or is it cells? Is it a body or is it cells? And I was just deep in this. And then the light changed and people next to me stepped off the curb and I couldn't move because my leg had become a flock of cells. Mm-hmm. And then the moment passed and it reassembled into a leg and I could keep walking. So I had that experience. And I'm not sure how long after, I think it was just a few weeks, I was at the Zen Center, Village Zendo in New York. And I was this Thursday morning opener in case anyone came by. And back in those days, no one came by on Thursday mornings for the most part. So I was sitting there by myself in the Zendo and I had lit the incense on the altar and I was sitting at the other end. Doing Zazen. And I was following my breath. But I was not doing that. I just could not let go of cells or body, cells or thing. And at some point during that, my eyes lifted up and I saw the incense on the altar turning into smoke. And there was a moment of incense smoke, body cells. That's emptiness. That's emptiness of inherent existence. And I felt it. Me and the incense sort of like boundaries disappeared, and there was a moment. At least I got a moment.
Yeah, he was saying, like, would you count? He was saying, like, that word, a Satori or a Kensho, and it was like, that's that moment, right? Yeah, you get that.
Yeah, and I just don't like putting labels on that because people like, oh, you got a Kensho, whatever. Yeah,
fair enough.
I prefer awakening to enlightenment. That's also not, you know, these terms are so loaded. And people think, and people make the mistake, particularly, you know, even people within the practice. Oh, once you get that, everything changes. Everything's fixed. Well, no, we're still us. Back to nirvana, back to samsara. But I had that moment. And in that moment, suddenly the science practice and the spiritual practice were not separate in any way. And I was not looking for that. I was not hoping for it. It was no ambition I ever had. And yet in that moment, suddenly they were just the same thing. And that's been with me since. And the book is really an expression of that moment and unpacking what that means in every way I could explore it. I took that insight into my Zen teacher in Dokusan in one-on-one interview, as we do in Zen practice. And I said, I think this is what emptiness is. And she said, uh-huh. And I said, I thought it was way more complicated than that. And she said, no, it's pretty simple. It's just not easy. But everything then, I mean, it was very quick. I could use that complexity analysis, cells and body, that could lead to interdependence and impermanence and karmic law. And then I started seeing how it lined up with all sorts of aspects of Jewish mystical practice and insights. And, you know, that's what I've been doing since.
Yeah, Danny and I were talking a little bit about the character for qi, since we're, you know, Chinese medical people, and it shows the rice in the pot and then the steam coming up. So when I was listening to your story, I was like, yeah, that has that feeling to it.
Yeah.
Exactly that feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you are really resting in the moment, where's the separation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But how do you really rest in that moment?
That's the question.
Yeah. My mom did that. That's partly why I want to write her story. In her later years, she lost her short-term memory. Her long-term memory is totally intact, but she couldn't remember 5 minutes ago. I always wondered what it would be like if I had been able to get her stoned. And then now I discovered what it would be. What were we talking about? Is there any food in the house? But she was a pretty anxious woman when I was growing up. There was a lot on her plate, and she had grown up in World War II, et cetera, et cetera. And she was married to a Holocaust survivor. But in these years, that was gone. And I said to her once, you know, you're even smiling when you're sleeping now. How do you stay so happy? And she said, well, I don't really worry about the future anymore, and I can't remember the past, so all I have is the now. Mm. And when you live in the now, you're happy.
Mm.
Now, I sit on a cushion, or tell myself I'm not sitting on a cushion enough. How much of the time? And here she just, you know, she arrived there.
Yeah, so almost like when we were talking about her, because you do talk about her in the lectures we listen to, you know, it's not as much in the book. Doesn't seem to me. It looks like maybe I heard.
No, it's not. It's that's another book. That's the other
book. That's the book you wanted to write, and now you're getting to it. Yeah, gladly. Thankfully enough.
Little obstacles in the way.
Yeah.
It almost seems like we're going to get to this at some point, because it's consciousness is such an important subject in the book, right? You're really exploring that. That's kind of like section three of the thing, which is very strong. And it almost seems like for your mom, maybe certain parts of memory were lost, certain parts of cognition were lost, but it almost seems like part of her consciousness kind of expanded.
Oh, absolutely.
Describe her having these kind of like metaphysical kind of insights, intuitive, like the way you talk about Gödel, that seemed to match things in physics. Like, she seemed to, like, her consciousness kind of expanded. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why I it's hard to avoid the language when you're talking about someone who's older, who has cognitive changes, and we want to say, well, they're demented. Was she, is that the word we use for who she became? She died in a bliss bubble. You know, she was just this nuclear reactor of mother love that was very uncomplicated. That eventually, I mean, this is a whole other story, and I don't know if I'm going to put it into her book. But I also had parallel to all of this stuff is, do you know who Mother Mira is? Are you familiar with her?
Yeah, I've heard the name.
I've never heard of it. And the audience might not have either. So
yeah, so she's a woman who was born in India. She's my age or a bit younger, so I'm 64. So, but she was found as a young person and thought to be a human incarnation or avatar of the Divine Mother. And eventually, for various reasons, she wound up in Germany and people started visiting her. And I read books about her in the early 90s. And I thought, and I read books about Ramakrishna, founder of Vedanta in that lineage in the mid 19th century, and how, because he was an avatar, he could touch people and they would become enlightened. And I thought, if I ever hear of an avatar, I'm going to go.
The Shakti Patras.
For that reason, right. Ooh. It didn't work that way. But I went to visit her. And after a friend of mine had died, this was the AIDS era. And there was a lot of death. That's another book. The one after. And I had some very intense experiences. No flashing, you know, I don't get the flashy stuff. You said plant medicine. I tried ayahuasca once. Everyone in the room was in a bliss state or, you know, in a hell realm. I drank what everyone else had. I got a little bit extra because not much was happening. And finally, around 3 a.m, I thought, Mother Aya is in the room. Okay. And her message for me was, this is not your path. And I was like, okay, really? Really? I'm sort of condemned to doing a lot of hard work.
Okay.
But she... at one point, so this was her thing, was all about connection with the Divine Mother. And it was 1999. So a little before my mom started to enter her decline. And I was doing the California AIDS bicycle ride to raise money for AIDS services from San Francisco to LA. And on day 4, I was lying on the side of the road in the hard scrabble, and I was in this pocket where there were no bicyclists behind me and none ahead of me. And I was desperately thirsty. I'd run out of water and the sun's beating down on me. And I'm thinking, what the fuck was I thinking? And then I thought, there's the sun beating down on me. And Mother Mira is all about bringing the light down. I thought, okay, let's try and turn this into that. And the sun in my imagination became her face. And the sunlight coming down became that light. And I started to relax and chill out. And as I was getting ready to pick myself up and get back on the bicycle, feeling revived, and I recognize all of this might have just been my psychological thing in the moment. There's nothing necessarily magical here. But I promised that I hadn't been to visit her in Germany in a number of years. And I said, I'll come to visit within the next year. I made that sort of vow.
Yeah.
And I kind of heard, you don't need to come visit me. Just go visit your mother in Forest Hills. She's an expression of the Divine Mother as much as I am. And from that moment, that's how I sort of started interacting with my mom. I didn't tell her this, but taking care of her became in part that devotional practice. And in her later years, when I say she became a nuclear reactor of mother love, what it really was an experience of and continues to be after she's gone is, oh, this is what the Divine Mother brings to things. This is what a relationship with the Divine Mother is about.
I think you have your Jungian connection right there.
Yeah. But, you know, so that comes out from left field. And post-COVID, that's become a very rich part of my practice, too.
Mm.
So I'm, you know, all these balls are up in the air. Most people don't let me talk about this stuff or don't ask. So thank you very much.
We prefer it, to be honest.
Super interested. Okay, I wasn't sure how we were going to talk about this, but I was reading your book. We're riffing. So.
Okay, sure.
Oh, you know, in Chinese medicine, they talk about kind of like in the Tibetan Book of the Bardo and things, you know, the body joins with spirit or Shen or soul or what consciousness, whatever word you like, right? You know, Taoist culture, Chinese medical culture, they tend to use this word Shen. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when the Shen and the body separate, they call it yin yang separating, right? Mm-hmm. And there is this notion that there can be these kinds of clarity of consciousness things that appear, that in a certain sense, the body is, you know, your connection to this place, you know, this mortal coil. But as you separate away, more subtle aspects of experience maybe become possible, or even blisses and joys. Mm-hmm. I remember talking with a friend of mine, Russian Jewish scientist, biologist, you know, he came up with like the pumps for multi-drug resistance. That was his big thing. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but really great guy. And we were talking, he was like a chronic smoker and eventually he did get lung cancer. And we had a party for him to say goodbye, you know, and he was out on the porch, of course, grabbing a smoke. And I went out to talk with him and he said, I can't explain it to you, but this is the most blissful I've ever been in my life. Mm. And I love everyone. I feel at peace with everyone. You know, I wish I could share it with you in this direct way. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
But there's a clarity with this. And I was, you know, I didn't say it to him, you know, I was already a Chinese medical person, but I was thinking, yeah, that's that moment, you know, when this separates. And in some ways, even the consciousness clarifies. So when you were talking about your mom having insights into the Planck length and the universe not being smooth, but having little, I was like, okay,
spaces, you know, like dicing carrots, she said. And so is time. And her response, and she experienced it as incredibly beautiful, and said exactly, I wish I could, that, you know, you and Mark and the kids, her grandchildren, my brother's kids, could experience it the way I do. It's just so beautiful. That was the thing about my mom, is that she was, you know, sort of declining, became acutely sick, went into hospice care, stopped walking, talking, and eating for 7 months. And we had her in home hospice care, and I was there every single day because this is probably going to be her last. Oh, no, not yet. And then after 7 months, I got a call from her home attendant. Mr. Neal, come quick. Your mother's in the kitchen asking for a cup of tea.
Wow.
And she lived for another 6 years.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
And,
okay.
And a friend of mine came up with a good title for the book that so far is still the working title, Sarah in the In-Between.
Mm.
Because she was partly in this world and partly in Yiddish, the Yenevelt, the other world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she just hovered there. You meet people who, as they're dying, may have some hours, some days, maybe even a few weeks. It went on for years.
Wow.
But one of the interesting things about this, you know, she really was in a bliss state. And you think, well, you know, a taste of nirvana, mm-hmm. but she needed 24-hour home care. You can't live in a bliss state like that because you won't be able to feed yourself because you're not in this world in mm-hmm. that way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I think this is, you know, the trick of so many of our spiritual practices, if you're looking for a depth of experience, it's not getting to a destination. It's finding how do you balance those and how flexibly do you shift between those. I am this body. I am these cells. I am these molecules. And there's no, I am the quantum foam. I am the underlying fundamental awareness that emanates everything. All of those things are equally true.
Yeah.
If the moment we select one and say, oh, this was my destination, you've missed it. Wow. Which is such a Zen thing, right? It's such a Buddhist thing. Oh, you missed it. Why? Because you chose.
Okay. Yeah. I remember Hosokawa Roshi saying something like, you have to like, there's a part of you that's connected to this body too. And if you didn't have that part, you just walk off the roof by accident or walk in front of a truck. Yeah. It's both of those things are kind of always in play, right?
Now I don't know how consciousness, you know, what is the element that separates? Theoretically, there is no such thing as separation. In the model of understanding existence that I explore in the book, well, material reality doesn't in fact exist. So the body itself is not a material thing that has to separate from a spiritual thing. It's all just pure awareness. So they're not different things. They may be different processes within the substance, Spinoza's one substance. Within non-dual fundamental awareness, as my collaborator Manas and I talk about it in our academic papers, it's giving rise to material existence. It's giving rise to our minds. It's the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's only this human existence that teaches us to think that those are separate things, but they're just complementary, the yin-yang. They're different views. Is it that, you know, is it, if you're calling it yin-yang, yin never exists without yang. Yang never exists without yin. That's why a yin-yang symbol, not only do they meet perfectly and intertwine, but they also have little dots of the other within them. Mm-hmm. So there is no separating, but there's this sort of shimmying where you become aware of the different aspects, perhaps, maybe. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I'm talking out of my ass right now.
No, no. We Eric and I were talking about this earlier because I've had some dreams that I was talking with him about, and we were kind of making a similar point, but kind of a koan that Eric and I both share independently. But how does consciousness or the Shen link with the DNA or the body or this thing? And like, how it is that, you know, like it's something, I mean, I've always been interested in. Eric said, you know, because Eric's known me, I've known Eric for over 10 years at this point, 12 years, something like this. And he's like, you've been interested in that since I first met you, you know, because it is such a big question. And, but then, you know, when you think about it to your point, it's like, well, I'm not sure that they're two separate components.
Well, they're not, you know, I mean, I have the courage of my convictions that I write about in the book. The universe does not make our minds, does not make consciousness. Our brains do not make minds. It doesn't, they don't make consciousness. The material aspects of the universe arise from non-dual mind, consciousness, awareness. English, we don't have good words for this.
Correct.
And the emanation of all this stuff gives us the illusion that we have to keep saying this and that, this or that. But there is no difference between the material substance of your DNA and the non-material substance of your mind. Because even material and non-material, that's duality.
Mm-hmm.
In the realm of the non-dual, these distinctions are utterly without meaning. And even the moment you get into, let's be some, you know, be hardcore complexity scientists here. The moment you say DNA, you have in your picture, probably, I would guess, not just a double helix lines with lines between them, but you probably have an awareness that these are atoms creating these structures.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen models of atoms that make up the molecule of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those atoms are just protons, neutrons, and electrons, which are quantum phenomena, which are made of leptons and quarks and muons. And now where's your thingness down there?
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about activated wave states of the entire universe at the quantum level, because non-locality and entanglement, to Einstein's great chagrin, are real. Yeah. That's why they won a Nobel Prize final.
Yeah.
Not that a Nobel Prize guarantees it's real, but and you're not, so then you're down at the quantum foam, and you're still not even in my frame of reference, in the stuff I cover in the book of different cultures, you're still not at the fundamental level.
Mm-hmm.
The fundamental below that, you're still talking distinctions. You're still talking wave versus particle. You're still talking momentum versus energy. You still got Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, where you have two things. Once you get below that, there's no distinctions. The bigger question to me is, and this was a puzzle, well, so first off, how does non-dual mind give rise to duality? And Minas is a Kashmiri Shaivist, and that tradition sort of supplied this piece of the puzzle. In their contemplative practices, they really try, and you know, every contemplative practice has questions it's asking. Mm-hmm. And what they find in their contemplation depends on the question asked. So in Buddhism, what's the end of suffering? In Judaism, it's how does, in Kabbalah, much of it is, how does the universe come into being every moment? Bereshit, in the beginning, bad translation. But how does creation continually renew itself? That's the question. Kashmiri Shaivism, how does the non-dual give rise to the dual?
Mm-hmm.
And what they talk about are these 20 tattvas or stages, where you have non-dual reality within which the urge to know itself arises, whatever that means, because it can't really mean anything at that stage. And then sort of there's a recognition that it contains within itself an I and a that. And then so there's a little shimmying there. And then they're sort of like, well, is that I? Or is I that? And there's a little movement there. And then finally, there's I am that. That am I. And then there's a separation.
Hmm.
To arrive at at duality, there has to be separation. How do you have separation? Well, there has to be dimensionality within which you can have separation. In non-dual awareness, there's no such thing in space and time. There's no such thing as past and future or here and there. It's just because it's beyond description. But the moment there's a recognition of self and other within itself, then there has to be dimensionality. And that's where space comes into existence and time comes into existence, and perhaps other dimensions, string theory-like. And the moment that happens, you have space-time, and that's an energy-rich field we know from quantum mechanics. And suddenly you have subatomic particles and atoms and molecules and all this material stuff, because non-dual awareness had an urge to perceive itself. And all of it, but they're all the same. There's no, at their root, we're just...
Right.
There I go on a toot.
You sort of get to the riddle of that thing then. And you know, you're using different metaphors to describe that in the last section of the book. Because mm-hmm. then they get to this point of like, well, how does this non-dual, like ontological ground of being thing, right? Mm-hmm. That still is everything. My finger, my hat, you know, this thing over here. It's still that, right?
Yeah.
But then you also get to the, and this is the koan maybe. How does that also get to be individual experiencing mm-hmm. individual agents or something? And
right.
You do address that in kind of interesting ways at the end of that deep part at the end, where you're exploring these different systems of thought, Kashmir Shaivism and the Kabbalah and the Zen and the Vedanta. You have that section at the end,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is, you know, very unique part to have such a sciencey book and then the flip of the switch, and here we are. So I can't remember entirely how you talk about all that, but you do say, well, these are still sort of the riddles. So how are you thinking about those things now? I'm trying to remember how you framed it, because I was listening to it kind of last night. And you were kind of talking, okay, here's are still the things that are still sort of the questions. We have to have individual consciousness within this whole thing. And then how's that connect? What's the brain actually doing relative to this? All those kinds of questions kind of pop up again.
Well, so the
conventional truth as opposed to the ultimate truth, if you want to be a little Buddhist-y about it. Yeah.
You know, the first thing, what's the brain doing in all this? Because I can't dismiss the brain as having import.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that.
But so we have all these great correlations between ways of looking at the brain, like fMRI and EEG and contents of awareness. You know, someone sees something in their mind or actually, and their visual cortex lights up. So, you know, hardcore materialists, which comprise most of our culture, say, well, the visual cortex is producing the sensation. No, there's not, there's a correlation there. But there's no place in the brain that you can point to that says this is the source of the experience of awareness. This is the so-called hard problem of consciousness. That no matter how much they want to say otherwise, cognitive neuroscientists are still stuck with. That's why every paper they publish talks about anything they find is a neural correlate of consciousness. They're never allowed to say it's consciousness because all they got is correlations. In which case, what's the brain doing? The easy answer is it's like a radio that's taking in radio waves and turning it into an experience.
Right.
It's a transducer of consciousness. You don't expect to open a radio and there's the Beatles playing inside. You know that there's an infinite set of radio waves extending in all directions that include the Beatles. And if you tune in at the right frequency, you can hear the Beatles. But we also know, because our computers, this was a big thing probably when you were eight. You could play music on your computer, but you could get a light show too. And so you could turn radio waves, which we think of, well, that's sound, isn't it? No, it's just radio waves. You can transduce it into light. You can transduce it into vibrations that a deaf person can experience as music, all sorts of things. So the brain of a bee samples fundamental non-dual reality of awareness and mind and has bee experience, and we have human experiences. There is no world out there that's independent of us, and this is what drove Einstein mad. And it's what led to his, to some extent, his bad science that didn't allow him to accomplish what he wanted. But at the same time, his critiques of this in quantum physics are what led to things like non-locality and entanglement. He was saying, no, these are impossibilities. So if your ideas lead to these, your ideas are wrong. Turns out, no. That's where they go. And he was smart enough to see it, but he couldn't accept it.
I had a delightful afternoon experience because I was teaching my little class on physics for Chinese medical students. And I got to talk about the brain as a transducer because I was doing Maxwell's equations and, you know, all the waves going everywhere. And I was saying, well, these waves are why you have all this telecommunications and, you know, the radio is there, you know, and it's picking up the waves that are there anyways, right? You know, those waves are there regardless of whether or not the radio's there. The radio just latches onto it, right? And that seems to be like kind of how you're talking about that.
No, that's exactly it. And I think it's a very nice, elegant solution. And in these terms, the hard problem ceases to exist. It just dissolves. The problems we were talking about, well, you know, is it the body? Is it the mind of stuff? All of these cease to be problems. They dissolve as questions because everything is just awareness. Everything is only experience. There is nothing to make experience because experience is all there is. But we're not brought up to think that way. Right. In other cultures, this is easy because, you know, some indigenous cultures, some religious communities, these are simple. You know, but in our contemporary post-Newtonian, you know, and Newton himself, no one, you know, he wrote thousands upon thousands of pages about alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I'm proud of my little class because I teach that to students every semester now. And like, he's a mystic. That's the reason he likes this gravity where everything's pulling on everything, everything right. everywhere
right.
all at once.
Right. So why didn't you write my book and save me the trouble?
Well, and I wouldn't get a chance to read your delightful book from my
all
side.
Right, all right, all right, all right. You can write a follow-up.
And have that enjoyment.
So, Neil, Eric and I were having this. So I have two questions for you, but we'll start with this one because it seems to be related to what we're talking about.
And you have to remember the other one because the way I answer, you may never get back to it. So,
well, I know I will. You've actually, I had like four questions I wanted to ask, but you've already gone through and answered them already. So,
okay,
so only two are remaining, and one comes from Eric and I's conversation earlier today, but we were talking about spiritual practice, meditative practice, and development, or Rory Hiltbrand, who was one of the other presenters at that conference that you gave a presentation to, had a really beautiful saying that instead of calling it like development or the path of enlightenment, he called it a continual act of devotion, which I quite like that. So talking about practitioners who are enlightenment seeking or meditative seeking or, you know, giving continuous acts of devotion, however you want to talk about it. In this country in particular, or in the West, we can say, which is a lot of people, and I'm sure there's a lot of practitioners. It's not exactly pop culture, but there are plenty of people all over this country and probably in Europe who give themselves more or less to the process of awakening. We'll see it or we'll say it. But Eric and I was kind of talking with Eric before about difficulties in practice and marrying things together. Like you talk about body versus cells, which was, you know, you're kind of koan for quite some time, inadvertently or advertently, who knows where karma comes into all of this. Do you have a feeling from your travels, your discussions, your 34, 35 years of Zen practice, something like this, Neil? Yeah.
37.
37. It's a long time.
Yeah.
So do you feel...
You could ask why I haven't gotten Dharma transmission yet. I'm slow.
Maybe you have. It just hasn't come out yet, you know? Do you feel that it is more difficult, or that there are obstacles that are more present now than times past? Do you not feel that way? Or do you think that we are more capable, therefore we can deal with these obstacles as they are coming about? Or... this is the school of hard knocks, and this is what we need to go through. Like, where do you fall on this? Because, you know, I've been blessed by having some really great people and teachers like Eric in my life who have brought this to my attention. And I have some other Vajrayana teachers and some yoga teachers who also talk about this as an impediment to practice, actually being around, I don't know, electromagnetic fields, as Eric and I kind of talked about earlier. Is it a collective consciousness that might be a sort of haze over our ability to connect, if you will? So I just wanted to kind of give you this as the premise and hear what you thought about it, because Eric and I talked about it earlier. And I was like, let's ask Neil tonight.
I don't know.
Okay.
however, I do have things to say about it.
That's fair.
I don't think we have anything to say about how easy or hard it was in other generations. For one, I think about my father's parents who were teenagers in Germany when World War I started. My grandfather was in the trenches. His brother was there for the Christmas truce, if you know what that is, in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And then survived, came back home. The Great Inflation, and then the Great Depression, and then there are Nazis, and then they're dead. And so nowhere in there did they have any opportunity for a quiet, undistracted spiritual practice. But people I've spoken to who were alive and knew them talked about how joyful their household was, my father's household that he grew up in, how warm it was. And I had a strong sense of how deep their devotional practice was in Jewish forms. So that's one thing. Number two is I'm not, I can see where you might say contemplative practice is sort of a form of devotional practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I don't know, Vedic, Vedanta, Hindu generally, I'm not sure where it's deriving from, but there's this notion of there are categories of practice. There's scholarship, there's devotion,
mm-hmm.
there's the path of service, the path of contemplation. There's a fifth one I think I'm not thinking of.
This one's kind of philosophical or something, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Meditative
yeah.
or something, yeah. Like yeah. Bhakti's yeah. devotional
scriptural
one.
Scholarship yeah. versus philosophy.
Yeah.
For years, I tried to get my mother to meditate. And she was just not having it. And eventually, this is before her advanced years. I was watching her light Shabbos candles on Friday night, the Sabbath, the candles that marked the Sabbath coming in. And I just thought, that's it right there.
Mm.
She's got this devotional practice that is every bit as rich and deep and intimate as my contemplative practice aspires to be, but her path is devotion. And my husband, he's very supportive of all this stuff that I do.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try and talk religion, when we first met, he's not Jewish, and I was more observant then, but he's the food guy. And we met, and it was our first week, and it was Friday night, and I said, I'd like to do a Friday night dinner, the Sabbath thing, and with the candles and the wine and the whole ritual. And I thought, well, I should translate the stuff for him from the Hebrew so he knows what it was like. Oh, no, don't ruin it. Right now it's theater. Don't turn. I don't want to hear about that. He's just completely uninterested. And it took me again a long time to realize you want to know what his practice is. It's service. Mm. And you watch him prepare a meal. And that's his practice.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he becomes intimate with the world and the people around him. So I hesitate to want to mush these things together because sure. I think people are different. And, you know, in the Buddhist terms, we talk about skillful means. You got to, in Jewish lore, there were 600,000 Jews at Mount Sinai when the Torah was given. And so there are, in fact, 600,000 different versions of the Torah, one for each of them.
Mm.
So I'm not, you know, I think the bigger question, these are interesting questions that you're asking,
mm-hmm.
but I guess as I've gotten older, I don't have time. I'm very aware that my time is, you know, I had two strokes this year, a shoulder replacement. Now I'm getting a hip, a shoulder repair. Now I'm getting a hip replacement. It's been a hard year. And I published a book. It's been quite a roller coaster. Those questions don't help me know what I should do.
Mm.
And they don't help me guide other people into what they might do. They're interesting things to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my instinct now is to, but what's the thing? I'll leave the interesting questions like that for people who are younger.
Maybe there's kind of a Zen pragmatism in that too. I'm here now. I have to start here. I can't start.
Yeah,
maybe it would have been better if I would start at someplace else. Maybe it would have been better. I have to start here. Maybe that's that kind of thing too.
Yeah, and I'm not being dismissive.
No, not at all.
Of what you're saying. I understand where the urge comes from. This is, I mean, gnawing on those kinds of questions are part of how I got to where sure. I am.
Yeah.
You know? So it's all process.
And this sort of leads me then into my other question, because of course I'm not going to forget. In the book and just now you talked about how these spiritual traditions are probably viewing the same phenomenon or similar phenomenon with different lenses. But what struck me as even more interesting than that, because I have this view also, was that your idea of pointing out the questions that they're asking and this informing how it is that they are pursuing the answers and then thereby giving rise to practices and so on and so forth, ways of being, ways of living. Given all of this, given your experience after writing this book, you know, as it's these kind of conversations hopefully opened up for you. And I've listened to one of the talks that you gave at a library in Connecticut. And you said that you've had some, sometimes you have really great questions from people that make you think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
people who ask me questions I haven't thought to think about. Oh, this is the fun part.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I'm, you know, I'm not putting you on your spot. You could certainly kick the can down the road, but like you mentioned in Buddhism that they were wondering, you know, how do we end suffering? You know, and in Judaism, how is it that we know the creation, or what is creation creating, or something like this? Have you thought about, you know, and these are just two questions of two very large spiritual traditions. Have you thought about questions, you know, we talked earlier about koans. Have you thought about a question or questions for yourself moving forward as everybody is asking you questions? Have you thought about questions, you know, that would give rise to something for yourself, you know, either moving forward or, you know, as you kind of organize what it is that you do? I know you mentioned just now you're kind of a pragmatic person, but you have a gnawing mind, I'm sure, you know, still lots of curiosity and have great desires for self-expression. And I would imagine that many of those come from query, from self-inquiry, and from things still yet not done chattering, you know, in your mind. And so I just wanted to ask you, like, what kind of questions like this are lingering for yourself? Because I've, you know, wanted to know.
Yeah. How do I finally figure out how to get out of my way? You know, the one way of summing up everything in the book is, you know, in Zen terms, what's Dogen talking about? Zazen itself is the thing. There's no, there's nothing to be gained. When I'm sitting here as this body, I am very truly, completely nothing but awareness turning into the appearance of this body sitting here with this personality that thinks of itself as real. And every single goddamn moment that I'm sitting there pondering that, I'm separate from the experience of the fact that that is it. So, you know, with the strokes, it was, there were no lesion associated. I had two little strokes up here. There were no lesion associated deficits, but what became very clear days after, and it's still lingering and it's problematic for me at work, is I can no longer multitask. I can't do two things at once. I turn into a little anxious chihuahua backed into a corner, and if you come near me, I'm going to snap. There's a little moment of panic. And my first response was, I've got too many things to do. How can I not even do two things at one time? And then I thought, big shot, you've been a Zen student for how long, trying to learn how to do one thing at a time? Mm-hmm. Well, you haven't learned how to do that really well. And the universe has come along and handed you this gift or hit you with a baseball bat. I can only do one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big piece of where I am now. Can I, you know, I haven't been given an option. This is what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. The other thing, though, as I say that, is I also have fallen into this shamanic thing, which is part of my mother's story. I have experienced non-material realms, and they are populated by non-material conscious living beings. They can influence us. We can influence them. That's mm-hmm. kind of what shamanic practice is in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a shaman, and so we're doing that now these days too. How do you explain that? How do you put that into the context of my complexity theory model of the universe? Where's that? Are those realms of pure mind? And I have a scientific theory about what this all is, and I'm debating whether to put that in my mother's book. Because I think there is a way to solidly do that, which it's up to you whether I just hand it to you right now or leave it for later.
So you know, Eric has been highly influenced by Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. I've been highly influenced by Tibetan Buddhism and shamanism, you know, and we've had my teacher on, Mary Kay Ryan, who was, you know, a great influence on me. But then obviously I'm leading retreats. I'm teaching classes on this very topic. And Zen and Tibetan Buddhism is based on shamanic practice. I mean,
It's rife with non-material beings appearing out of the blue.
But then in the practical kind of aspect, because I'm a Capricorn, so we're going to have some practicality. I know you two Geminis in the building, but we need someone with all of our feet on the ground, all four hooves, or sideways on a mountain.
With two horns.
That's right. So we're horny.
Transducing.
But it is on how it's a lived practice. So it is visionary and it is influential, but it's influential on reality. Right. It doesn't only exist in like just this place where when you close,
they are not separate. But how do you know, I have what seems to be a complete model of existence that contains everything. Where's the room for that? Or do I have to invoke some weird magic? And I don't think you have to. We have something called dark matter that everybody's in agreement. We have dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
The way scientists, for the most part, talk about dark matter is that it's this brute kind of dumb substance that the only thing it can interact with other things through is gravity. So that's how we can detect it's there. It helps shape galaxies. But we can't see it. It's not dark because it's evil. It's dark because we can't see it, hear it, touch it. There's no other... There's no communication via electromagnetism, via weak force, via strong force, only through gravitation. But what makes us think that it doesn't have ways of interacting with itself? Yeah. There's nothing that says that. In fact, isn't that kind of crazy?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think dark matter should be able to perceive itself and interact with itself? And if it is arising from space-time, let's not even go to fundamental awareness yet, let's say it's arising from space-time because it is in space-time, then it's got to be arising in some sort of dark matter quantum foam too. It may not be strings or particles, we have no idea what they might be, but if they do and they can interact with each other, then according to the rules of complexity theory and chaos theory, they're going to interact with each other to lead to larger scale structures that then behave like things which interact with each other. And suddenly you have non-material living conscious beings arising in the universe that have no meeting point with us, except where we meet is in fundamental awareness. Mm. So the way we can access them is through consciousness. One of my teachers, this was kind of a turning point for me. He said, To us, their world is dreamlike and really hard to grasp and perceive with any sort of solidity. To them, our world is the dream.
Mm.
Because where we both come from is just pure awareness. And so I don't think these things are separate.
Mm.
I'm going to call you Dr. Thies right now because that was a very deep idea and deserves the honorific title. I hadn't thought about it that way. That's a very creative application of that idea.
I think so.
The whole dark matter thing. Who's to say that doesn't have all kind of complexity and, you know, consciousness and life teeming within it? Why would it not?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The dark energy, dark matter thing. That's creative. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's great. Sure. Yeah, that's good, that's man. That's
a creative twist. I hadn't thought of it that way. Because the.
So I should put that in the next book.
I think that
rocks.
Yeah. I think that rocks. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if we're your target demographic, but you know, we both give you, you both gave us like one of those moments of like, ooh, oh, that's good. Yeah,
that's creative.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are part of my target demographic, right?
There
are people out there. If you read my Goodreads reviews. You know, I'm still above 4.0, but there are 20% of the people just hate me and are so dismissive. It's interesting, though, where they usually tear me apart is you don't understand quantum physics. Well, you know, I've got some high power quantum physicists like the founders who are on my side, as well as some contemporary ones. No one ever tries to tear me apart on the good old stuff. Because they don't get it. And right. Interestingly, no one has yet said, oh, that transducer idea for the brain makes no sense. And some of these are like neuroscientists who you know, excoriate the book because, what do I, you know, brain makes mind. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. So I find it interesting that if I'm not pushing someone's buttons, I haven't written the book I'm supposed to write.
Yeah. I was just going to say, if no one's hating, I don't know that you're doing it right.
Right. And, you know, someone asked me the other day, aren't you worried about your reputation? And I'm like, my reputation that pays my bills is being a liver pathologist. And I'm really good at being a liver pathologist. And they don't care when I give them a diagnosis on a patient's biopsy, what crazy religious ideas I have or philosophy or, you know, that I do ayahuasca on the weekends or whatever, as long as I'm not doing it while I'm looking at the biopsy.
Right.
So I'm lucky that I have a career that keeps me safe. Academically, who's going to touch me? You know, I have a salary.
You have a good research resume too. I mean, you not like you haven't made your research
right.
Like,
yeah. Right.
You know, contributions, you certainly have.
Well, yeah. Listen, Neil and Eric, Neil, you asked us to be
gotta go.
A little bit about time.
Yeah.
And it's
you gotta work early in the morning and get back to that.
30 minutes before your bedtime, and we want to give you your downtime. But thank you so much for coming on tonight. I mean, this was really great. You know, I really appreciate you coming on. Eric and I were talking earlier, and it's just a wonderful, this particular venture is such a wonderful opportunity to meet people who we never would have met before. You know, if I was taking that lecture with you in December, and I would said, oh, he's really cool, I'd like to meet him, I'm not going to message you, hey, Neil, let's talk on the phone for a while. Why, Daniel?
People do. People do.
Do they?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, okay. I'm going to be in New York. You want to hang out?
Really?
This year it's been really easy. I had a couple of strokes. I'm recovering from shoulder surgery. I've got a hip problem. But ultimately, I barely have time for friends and family. But this kind of stuff is also nourishing for me. You know, meeting other people who are engaged, take my work seriously, have their own experiences they're bringing to it. I'll tell you, I had a really hard day. This hip thing is sort of making me a little insane. And today I was not so strong in the face of it. And now I feel really good. So thank you for the good medicine.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for your work, for your insights. It's definitely been a great ride listening to your book, listening to your lectures, and then having you here today. It's like it feels like we've come full circle, and it feels like I have an ally in one Mr. Neil. So thank you so much for making the time.
Sure.
And thank you so much for being like, you're sharing so much.
Yeah.
When Daniel asked you this question, it's like, oh, this is coming from the heart. So thank you so much for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the image of your
otherwise,
mom.
Why bother?
Your image of your mom lighting the candles and the Shekinah divine mother appearing. And, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah. When you were giving your talk at that seminar, I was like, oh yeah, this is, we're in the same tree, you know, whatever tree that is. Well,
that's a nice thing to find people.
Yeah,
growing up, it was kind of like, who am I and where am I going to fit in here?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, oh, I'm me. There's lots of places to fit in.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe there's more of us out there, right?
Yeah.
By looking at people responding to your book, there are people who know these things.
All right, my brother. Well, we'll let you run, but thank you so much for coming on. If anybody has questions or, you know, comments or whatever for Neil, please email us at jinandtantra@gmail.com. Neil, at the beginning of this episode, I'm going to give all your bios and all that other stuff so people can get a hold of you and buy Neil's book. We'll have the link to it in the description of the podcast, both on YouTube and on the audio version. So wherever you're getting it from, like, comment, subscribe, do all the things that help the show grow so we can continue to have great conversations with people who are doing the real work in life and that influence our minds and our hearts, and hope they do the same for everybody who's tuning in today. So for Eric, Daniel, this is Neil. We'll catch you guys on the next one. Peace. I want you to get together. I want you to get together. Put your hands together one time.
together. I want you to get together.